I think maybe the write-up for today implies that you work on the busy work for a little bit, and then I speak later. I'm going to speak first, because you're not all going to be working at the same speed on this writing up the pre-lab, and therefore I don't want people waiting on other people for me to speak. We'll just get the lecture out of the way, and then the more efficiently the work that you work, the more likely it is that you'll be able to get out early. Like I said, we don't have all that much scientific information to talk about today, but this is a course, even though it's a 300 biology course, there's no prerequisites for this, right? So there can be biology majors in here, or people who have never had a biology course, or a science course for that matter. And therefore, we have to talk about some real basic stuff. If you've already had courses, you've probably heard this several times. Just that's the way it is. But let me quickly talk about some scientific fundamentals, which really boils down to giving you some important definitions, sets of definitions. First of all, let's talk about the difference between quantities and units. Does anyone know what a quantity is? I don't mean to give me an example. I mean, what is a quantity? Yeah. That's one way. I mean, how many is actually an example of a quantity. But when you quantify how many there are, you're doing what? You're taking a measurement, right? And that's what a quantity is. Anything that can be measured, really, is a quantity. There's no limit to the number of quantities in the universe. What's an example of a quantity, though? Well, you gave an example. Number of things is itself a quantity. Number of particles, whatever those particles are. It could be planets, atoms, humans, whatever. But what are some other quantities?
The amount of liquid in a bottle.
Yeah, and what name would we give to the amount of liquid that's in a bottle? What would the quantity be called? What are you actually measuring when you measure the amount of liquid in a bottle? What is it?
Volume.
Volume, exactly. Volume is a quantity. Weight is a quantity. Mass is a quantity. They're not the same, by the way, right? Mass and weight are different, even though they're sometimes used interchangeably by people who should know better. Mass and weight are different. How are they different? What is mass? There's no crime in being wrong. The space that it takes is the volume. The mass is the amount of matter that's in that sample. How much matter makes something up? And what is the... Go ahead. Correct. Weight is an example of a force. All weights are forces. Not all forces are weights. But weight is a force. Weight is specifically the force due to gravity. And so notice that the amount of matter does not change if there's no gravity. You go out into space, you still have mass, but you no longer are exerting any weight. You're weightless. Okay? But what's some other quantities? There's no limit to quantities from anything that you measure. Distance, for instance, right, is a quantity. Area. Speed. These are all quantities. How are these different from units? Yeah. That's exactly right. Units are what we measure quantities in. So we have standard units for any given quantity. And often, for any given quantity, we have multiple choices of units to use. Broadly speaking, we have a choice between the silly system that the United States hangs on to, unfortunately, or the metric system. right, which the world uses and all scientists even in, here in this country use. But even if you are stick to within one system, you can have multiple units to choose from, right? For instance, if you talk about the Silly system, the quantity volume, you can use different units for. You can use cups, teaspoons, fluid ounces. Those are all volume units, right? So, does everyone understand the difference between a quantity and a unit just from those examples? Okay. Then let's make it a little bit more specific. Any given quantity can be categorized as either fundamental or derived. And those are mutually exclusive categories. So any given quantity is either fundamental or derived, not both. What's the difference? Anyone know what a fundamental quantity is? I mean, what it means to be fundamental? Well, it might help to give you an analogy with chemistry. A fundamental, an atom is fundamental compared to a molecule. A molecule would be derived because it's made up of atoms. Okay? Some number of atoms. They might be the same kind of atoms, but as long as it's two or more atoms, then you are no longer fundamental. And similarly, a quantity is derived if it really is just made up of multiple quantities. Whereas a fundamental quantity stands by itself. It is its own thing, not made up of other quantities. Well, I said that there's really no limit to the number of quantities in general. That's true. But there is a surprisingly small number of fundamental quantities. Fewer than 10 fundamental quantities. The rest of them are derived quantities. They're literally just combinations of those fundamental quantities. Can you name any fundamental quantities? What are things that seem to stand by themselves or not made up of other things? This is when the recording gets boring. Yeah.
Do you mean like an atom, or do you want even more like a proton, neutron, electron?
Well, though, I'm talking about quantities now.
Okay.
So of, you know, we mentioned some quantities. Were any of those fundamental quantities? Well, I mentioned at least one. Distance is a fundamental quantity. Distance is not made up of other things. Okay? Time is fundamental. In fact, your first example, number of particles, is a fundamental quantity as well. Right? But we talked about volume. That is not fundamental. That's a derived quantity. Why is volume derived? Yeah. Right, and what do we? How do we measure volume? Or how do we compute volume? If it's a cube, if it's a simple cube, how do we? What is the volume of a cube? Length times width times height. Well, length, width, and height are all really just specialized names for distance, right? So volume is really distance times distance times distance, and therefore it's a derived quantity because it's made up of three distances. Okay? Does that make sense? Area is also derived because it's distance times distance.
So then
with
mass,
mass is fundamental, another one, exactly. Weight, on the other hand, is not. Now, I told you that weight is a force. And what did Newton tell us force is equal to?
Mass times acceleration.
So just by stating it that way, you can see that force, any force, including weight, is not fundamental. It's derived because it's made up of mass and acceleration. In fact, acceleration by itself is already derived, right? Because acceleration is equal to distance per time per time. It's made up of multiple quantities. So, does everyone understand the difference between fundamental and derived quantities? Well, you can use the same adjectives for units. There are, each unit is, any given unit is either fundamental or derived as well, simply based on what the corresponding quantity is. So any unit of a fundamental quantity is a fundamental unit. And any unit of a derived quantity is a derived unit. Therefore, volume being derived has units that are derived. Cubic centimeters, which is a unit of volume, is a derived unit. Seconds, on the other hand, which are units of time, are fundamental units because time is a fundamental quantity. Is all that straight? Okay, now, I asked that question in other courses, and I always get unanimous yeses. But then when I ask on a quiz for you to demonstrate the knowledge of the difference between fundamental and derived quantities and units, I get a lot of people who aren't able to demonstrate that knowledge. So if you have any questions, ask me about that. But if everyone's clear on that right now, we'll go on to some more definitions. Next is a batch of three definitions. Difference between accuracy, precision, and resolution. Who wants to tell me what accuracy is? Okay. That's a very good definition, but for the wrong thing. That's precision. Precision is repeatability of measurements. Okay? Accuracy is closeness to the truth. So any given individual measurement has a degree of accuracy. If it's very close to what the truth is, then it's highly accurate. But for precision, you really need to talk about a group of measurements, not just one. And if that group of measurements are close together in their values, if you're measuring the same thing over and over, and the values are very close together, then that's high precision. Textbooks often use an analogy, which is a pretty good analogy, of a dartboard, throwing darts at a dartboard, representing the taking of measurements. And so the true value is represented by the center of the board, and the throwing of a dart represents the taking of a measurement. If you throw one dart, take one measurement, it could land anywhere, right? You might not even hit the board. If it doesn't even hit the board, that is a low accuracy measurement, right? If you throw a set of three darts, you're really taking a measurement of the same thing three times, right? Those darts can land anywhere as well, but they could land in a tight grouping. If they do, then that's high precision. But notice, they could be a tight grouping still in the wall instead of on the board itself. So it's possible to have high precision but low accuracy. All right. It's actually also possible to have low precision and high accuracy, because you could throw three on the wall, but they form a triangle that is centered right on the center of the board. So none of those individual measurements was accurate, but the average of them would be accurate, even though the precision would be very low. You see what I'm saying there? Now, obviously scientists strive for having both high accuracy and high precision, but sometimes it doesn't work out that well. On instruments, like a balance that you use to weigh things, precision refers to getting the same number. You know, if you put different samples on, you're going to get different measurements. But when I say repeatability, I mean if you keep weighing the same thing, take it off, put it back on, if you don't get the same reading each time, then you don't have maximum precision. But if you always get the same measurement, that's high precision. Now, how do both of these things, accuracy and precision, differ from resolution? What is resolution? Yeah.
Clarity of the results?
Clarity is a good adjective, yes, or noun, actually. It's good. Just it's a good synonym, at least in the visual example. But it's useful to explain resolution in terms of a visual example, even though it doesn't really necessarily have to have anything to do with vision. Resolution is a noun. What is the verb form of that noun?
Resolve.
Resolve, exactly. And to resolve means to discriminate. Discriminate means to tell the difference between, right? So if you're able to resolve, what that means is that you're able to tell the difference between two things that are different from each other. So using a visual example, if I use a Sharpie and put two little black dots on the wall, spaced some distance apart, if you stand close enough to those spots, you'll be able to resolve them. You'll be able to tell that they are two different spots. Okay? You'll have sufficient resolution to discriminate them. But if you stand back farther and farther, eventually there will be a distance at which you fail to resolve them. You've lost resolution, and it will look like just one dot to your eyeballs. Or to your brain, actually. The eyeballs just give the information to the brain. Okay? Go ahead.
Is the resolution also how clear you see something? Different?
Yes, but it's because of your ability to discriminate smaller and smaller objects. You know, a loss of resolution in digital imagery terms would be going to larger and larger pixels, right? When an image is pixelated, like when a broadcast news is trying to hide a bare breast, for instance, on American television, what they'll do is pixelate the image so that the resolution gets very low and you can't tell that it's a breast. All you have to just imagine it. All right? So that's resolution. And when we talk about the balance, resolution would be how many decimal places we can read our measurement to, right? This one happens to have a resolution of a hundredth of a gram. If you put two different samples on this individually and weigh them, but they differ by 0.03 of a gram, you're not going to notice any difference with them because this instrument doesn't have sufficient resolution to discriminate them, right? You'll get the same reading for both. And similarly, if you stand on a bathroom scale and tell me what your weight is, and then I hand you a postage stamp while you're still on there, and I say, okay, what's the combined weight of you and the postage stamp? You're going to give me the same number because the bathroom scale can't resolve such a small difference in weight. Yeah.
Is that also sensitivity? Accurate?
Yes, you can use sensitivity is used different ways, but yes, you can use that in similarly to resolution for an instrument. Okay, everyone clear on all those three? All right. Then let's just quickly talk about the metric system. Like I said, the metric system is the universal system now. For good reason, it's vastly easier than the English system that you probably grew up with. Sadly, there's only three countries left in the world that do not embrace the metric system, and the United States is one of them. 42 years ago, when I was in fifth grade, the teacher that day said, okay, we're going to learn the metric system today, and you should pay attention because within a couple of years, that's all we'll be using here. It hasn't happened still, and there's no indication that it's going to change in the near future. But it is a lot easier than memorizing a bunch of conversion factors like 1,760 yards per mile or 5,280 feet per mile, 12 inches per foot. You know, all of those things are much harder to remember than just powers of 10, which is what the metric system is based on. So depending on your quantity, you're going to have different units, right? Well, you can use what we call the base unit. You can always use that if you want. But sometimes it's more convenient to use some other unit that puts a prefix before the base, right? Either a smaller unit or a bigger unit. It's appropriate to use smaller units when we're measuring something very small. It's appropriate to use bigger units when we're measuring something very big so that we don't have to write either 0.0000 whatever number or whatever number followed by a bunch of zeros, right? By using the appropriately sized units, we can just write 12 instead of 0.000012, for instance. So the base unit, whatever it is, and it depends on what your quantity is. For instance, if your quantity is mass, what's the unit going to be?
Grams,
right. What if your quantity is weight, by the way? If it's weight, what is your unit going to be in metric? No, that's mass. Weight would be newtons. By the way, in the silly system, your weight is in pounds, right? What is your mass in? What is it? Well, I mean a single unit that we give the name of. It's the slug. So this is the system you grew up with. You didn't even know it was slugs for mass? A lot of people don't. Anyway, if you're using the base unit, like meters for distance, then there is not going to be a prefix, right? But we go up by three orders of magnitude, or we go down by three orders of magnitude for these major prefixes that the metric system uses. And what is an order of magnitude?
It's 10.
Yeah, it means a power of 10. So 10 is one order of magnitude bigger than 1. 100 is two orders of magnitude bigger than 1. It's one order of magnitude bigger than 10. See what I'm saying? In other words, it's how many decimal places you have to move it by to get to the other value. That's each movement of one decimal place is an order of magnitude. So we have prefixes that are bigger than the base, prefixes that are smaller than the base. What is the three orders of magnitude bigger prefix called? Kilo, right. And so that's the, when you use it as a word, you spell it out. As a symbol, though, it is lowercase k. Now, the rest of the ones that are bigger are all going to be uppercase symbols. By design, uppercase reminds you that those are bigger than the base. We don't use a capital K, though, even though kilo is bigger than the base. Anyone know why? Right. Uppercase K is already reserved for kelvins, which is the unit of temperature. Okay? So, 1,000 times a kilo, which would be 1,000,000 times the base, would be what? Mega. Capital M. Now, you would never use these symbols by themselves, because mega does not mean anything, right? So it's always this symbol right next to whatever the unit is, the symbol for the unit you're using. Like megameters, megagrams, and so on. Meganewtons. What's 1,000 times mega? Right. Capital G. And we can go up several more orders of magnitude, but usually that's not necessary for things that we normally do. On the smaller side, three orders of magnitude smaller than the base, in other words, 1/1000th of the base, is what prefix? I can't hear over this fan if you are saying anything.
Milli.
Yeah, milli. That's a small m, even though m also by itself means meter, so be careful with that. That's why you don't ever use it by itself, right? M by itself always means meter. Millimeter is mm, a millinewton, and so on. 1/1000th of a milli would be 1/1000th of the base. What is that prefix? Micro. Now, milli we used an M for obvious reasons, because it stands for milli. Micro also starts with an M, though, so we can't use M again. Therefore, we go to the Greek alphabet instead and use the Greek version of an M, which is a mu, right? It's not a U. It's a mu, which has a long tail to begin with it. That's not the same thing as this. This is a U, this is a mu, okay? But that's why a mu is used, because mu is another M. It stands for micro in this case. So micrometers, micro whatever. And if we go 1/1000th of that, which would be 1/1000000th of the base, what is that? Nano. Which is N. And we can keep going down orders of magnitude again. We'll go all the way down to 10 to the negative 15th at least, and all the way up to 10 to the positive 15th, which means the whole range covers 30 or so orders of magnitude, which is a ridiculously huge range. It should be plenty for everyone. But anyway, these are the only ones that you really should memorize if you haven't at this point. When it comes to converting from one to another, like how many nanometers there are in a millimeter, once you have a little practice with the metric system, that becomes no problem. But if you're not well practiced, what I recommend is going from where you are at the moment to the base, and then going from the base to where you need to be. So, for instance, if I say there you have 34 nanometers, how many micrometers are you going to have? Well, 34 nanometers would be how many meters, which is the base. Well, since nano means 1/1000000th, you're going to have to move that decimal place 9 places, right? To the right or to the left? To the left, because when you go to the base, which is a bigger unit, you're going to have fewer number of those, right? So you would have, what did I say was the number? 34? You would have 0.07 zeros, right? 3-4 meters. And then to go to whatever units you want, if I say how many kilometers is that, then you go from the base to kilo, using the knowledge that kilo means 1,000 of, right? So you would have to move the decimal place again. In which way would you move it? No, you'd move it to the left again, because you're going from, yeah, you're still going up in size. If I were to ask you to convert it to from nano to something smaller than nano, you would move it down. I mean, you would move it to the right. All right, everyone clear on all that? Then let me quickly tell you a couple things that are written here before I let you loose on the busy work. Oh, not quite. When it comes to measuring your volumes, which is what you're part of what you're doing today, you have multiple choices of instruments to use. You have graduated cylinders, which all these are, called that because they are cylinders that have little graduations on them. What are these things called? These are beakers. What is this? It's a flask, or an Erlenmeyer flask, more specifically. They all can contain liquids, of course. And really, they all have graduations on them. But graduated cylinders are what you really should use if you're trying to measure a certain volume. In other words, what I'm saying is, even though you have 100, 200, 300 milliliter notches on this beaker, that would be a very gross measurement, not very accurate. If you didn't really care about accuracy, you could just roughly get 600 milliliters. But if you wanted to get 600 milliliters as accurately as possible, you would use a graduated cylinder and the smallest one that you could use that could hold that amount. Why is it that you'd want to use the smallest one? But why is it more accurate? Well, I could have a graduated cylinder like this that has these notches and another one exactly the same size but with finer gradations. That wouldn't be as good, though, as going to actually one that is smaller in diameter. Why does going down in diameter increase the accuracy of your measurements? Yes. If you think about the difference between two... Well, if you just think about filling liquid into a cylinder, any given cylinder, it's going to fill up to a certain level, right? Well, if you put the same volume of liquid into two cylinders that differ in their diameters, the larger diameter cylinder is going to have a lower level. And any given amount of liquid that you add is going to raise that level a smaller amount. You put that same volume into a smaller diameter one, it's going to change the level drastically. In other words, you increase your ability to resolve tiny differences when you have a smaller diameter tube. That's why you use the smallest one for the job. This is a fairly small graduated cylinder, but sometimes you need to measure volumes that are much smaller than this can resolve, and therefore you go to pipettes. There's three different size pipettes shown here. This green thing is a pipetter, not a pipette. This is the pipette itself. You stick that into the end of the pipetter, and with your thumb you can suck up some volume using the scale. You can either push it back down to deliver it, use your thumb to deliver it, or you can push this and just open it up to the air and it will spill out. Okay, but that's for smaller volumes, and once again, you use the smallest pipette that can handle the job to maximize your accuracy. Even the smallest one, though, is too huge for very tiny volumes of liquid, which you often need to deliver in science. And that's why you would go to a micropipetter, which is what this instrument is called, that you never use by itself. You have to put a pipette tip onto it first. And you have to use the correct tip for the correct micropipetter because they come in different sizes. These are adjustable, though. It's really just a screw that you are turning that will determine how far it gets plunged to produce the suction. But these are often misused. First of all, you choose a micropipetter that's appropriate range. You use the smallest one that you can do in one shot. This one is listed as 100 to 1,000 microliters. So you would use it for anything in that range. You know, if you had to do 900 microliter transfer, you would use this. It has a resolution, the smallest increment that you can change it by, of 1 microliter. Okay? So every one of these numbers represents 1 microliter. You just dial in whatever you want. If it becomes hard to dial, don't just use more strength. That means you've reached one extent of the dial. And if you keep turning it, you'll jam it. Tell me if you do jam it, but pay attention to what the numbers are and don't go outside the range listed. Anyway, whatever you dial in, that's how much you're going to extract if you use this thing correctly. But assuming I have it dialed in for a certain amount, you never really want to touch the tips because they're sterilized. Instead, you just put this thing into a tip and you don't jam it extraordinarily hard. It forms a seal pretty easily. If you put it on there too hard, the ejector, which is what this thing is, which will pop the tip off without you having to touch it, will not have enough force to pop it off, and the whole thing will dismantle. So don't do that either. Anyway, once you have a tip on there and you've dialed in whatever it is you want, you have to use this thing correctly, and this is what people do often incorrectly. You have to realize that there is a stop that you can feel when you push this plunger. It naturally stops there, but if I use enough force, I can push it through that stop. Okay? Well, those two stops are for different things. The first stop is where I need to stop when I first push it down in order to extract whatever I've dialed in. Okay, so push it down to that stop, keep it there, put it under the surface, and let it suck it up. So that now contains 965 microliters. To deliver that wherever you want, then you actually put it all the way to the second stop so it forces it all out. That's all there is to it, but just make sure that you don't push it all the way down to suck it up, because you're going to be taking more than what you've dialed in, and that'll be wrong. Okay. Finally, just let me make sure I mention these things. You should have in your cases in the middle of the table, or things that you can use like micropipette tips and whatnot. But there's a plastic beaker in there that you're supposed to use only for tip waste. So don't put other kinds of things in there. So when you eject your tips off your micropipette or put them in there, if that ever fills up, even though it's not glass, put it in the cardboard glass container, because they poke through the bags otherwise. If you break glass, obviously it goes in the glass, and these micropipette tips do, but that's it. Don't put gloves or paper trash in the glass, even though it happens all the time. That's an important point of following instructions. There are signs saying you shouldn't do that. There is also a glass recycle bin. So don't just throw any glass into the glass. First check to see whether you're eligible to put it into the glass recycling bucket. Not all glass can be put in there, but just about all can. I've already told you that we can reuse the stuff, so don't throw away any of the liquids. Rinse your stuff today before you leave. So run some water through it and keep it in place as you found it. And importantly, every time before you leave, the last thing you should do is spray down your table with these spray bottles and rags that are sitting out. Don't forget that. And finally, and I would have forgotten to tell you this, for next time you should bring in an empty aluminum can as part of that procedure. We'll be doing fingerprinting next time. So bring in an aluminum can of some sort, doesn't matter what it is. That is it. Oh, well, no, it's not quite it. As part of fingerprinting, we'll be using carbon black, which can be messy. So if you don't wear a tuxedo next time, unless you don't have to get dirty if you're careful, but it's easy to get dirty. So don't wear something that you don't want to get black. Okay, that's it.